Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. It is Monday. I'm Charlie Sykes, and today's episode is brought to you by Quip. A quick reminder that you can subscribe to us on iTunes. Is it still called iTunes? Do they abolish iTunes? Apple Play, Google Play, Stitcher. And we really appreciate all of the support. We're going to be going into a new year where, obviously, on a daily basis, we're going to have a great deal to talk about, and we have a great deal to talk about today. So our guest today is actually probably one of our most frequent guests on this podcast, David Preece, who is the Chief Operating Officer of Lawfare. Thanks for coming back. Appreciate it, David.
Hello again, Charlie. Good to be back.
Well, we have a hell of a lot to talk about today. And it's hard to know where to start. Shall we start with the Colt 45 for a moment, because it's one of those, let's just remind ourselves where we are at and the context of a lot of the things that we're talking about. So let's start with Rick Perry, the former governor of Texas, the Secretary of Energy, who is on Fox. In case people haven't heard this, Rick Perry is explaining why he thinks that Donald Trump is the chosen one.
God's used imperfect people all through history. King David wasn't perfect. Saul wasn't perfect. Solomon wasn't perfect. And I actually gave the president a little one-pager on those Old Testament kings about a month ago. Hmm. And I shared it with him. I said, Mr. President, I know there are people that say, you know, you said you were the chosen one. And I said, you were. I said, if you're a believing Christian, you understand God's plan for the people who rule and judge over us on this planet in our government.
Okay, David, you tweeted out a little bit earlier today. Try to imagine anybody saying that about any other previous president of the United States.
Yeah, they would have been laughed off the set. They would have been not invited back. Perry should not be invited back for that kind of comment, and yet we all know he will be. I just find it hard to believe that we've entered a place where this is not the 1% of the 1% saying this and being shunted off into a corner. That this is mainstream media. These are mainstream personalities saying things about virtually worshiping the president of the United States.
Okay, so just so that we know this is not a complete one-off, we also have a soundbite from Franklin Graham, who is being interviewed by Eric Metaxas. Let me just stop right here. Eric Metaxas has written some, I think, pretty important, interesting books in the past, a very, very significant evangelical Christian writer who has somehow decided not just to go deep into Trump world, but to go, you know, into Trump world and through into a completely different place. So here is the conversation where the two of them are talking about whether or not opposition to Trump is in fact demonic.
And so what do you think of what is happening now? I mean, it's a very bizarre situation to be living in a country where some people seem to exist to undermine the president of the United States. It's just a bizarre time for most Americans.
Well, I believe it's almost a demonic power that is trying.
I would disagree. It's not almost demonic.
No,
I mean, you know, and I know that at the heart, it's a spiritual battle.
It's a spiritual battle. And
okay, so David, apparently, it's not enough that Never Trumpers are human scum. Now we have to regard them as demonic human scum. And I noticed that our good friend Peter Wehner has this long piece in The Atlantic basically explaining, no, we're not demonic. And it's like, are we really at the point now where we have to make the case, the argument? I told you before we started this that I'm unusually cranky today. And I think it's in part because we are sort of, we're not just in a post-truth world. We're just a post-rational world here, aren't we?
Well, I'm sick of it because, yes, rhetorically, we can dunk on this and talk about how stupid these people are for saying these things and other people are for taking them seriously. Yes, let's just get that out of the way. But this is more serious than that because the kind of rhetoric of elevating the leader to the dear leader, to the holy leader, to anyone who opposes this leader is demonic, to the fact that we are in their words, that we are in a spiritual battle. That is the kind of thing that we have looked at in other countries And it doesn't end well. This sets up a dynamic whereby it's not get to know your neighbor. You may disagree on marginal tax rates or on other public policies, but you're still in this together. It changes that from that society to a society in which you see other people as subhuman. This is not hopefully happening today because of these people saying this, but it shows that to the extent it becomes acceptable to hear this kind of thing and just shrug it off, that will set in with a certain subset of people, and it's going to go in a darker direction before light. Yeah.
Satan. Well, we're going to come back to this a little bit while, because there is this now sense on the right, or at least among supporters of Trump, about the absolute nature of the president's power, including his powers of commander-in-chief. And I want to talk about that. We're going to get to impeachment. But
He's anointed by God, and anyone who opposes him is demonic. Therefore, how could he have anything but absolute power, Charlie? Get with the program.
Well, this does seem to like relate to one another. For people who think we're exaggerating, you just need to listen to the way people are talking here. So I have a piece up at NBC News, think, about Devin Nunes and the way that Devin Nunes is redefined hackery. I mean, if we know that, okay, Devin Nunes is never going to be confused with Abraham Lincoln in terms of intellect, and he's clearly a political hack. But the distinctive nature of this hackery, this nihilistic hackery, where you are prepared to set your intellect and your reputation on fire, and you are willing to advance the most bizarre theories. And this is not a joke, because I think really one of the most powerful things that Fiona Hill said was urging members of Congress, do not become willing dupes of Vladimir Putin. Do not spread completely discredited, bogus conspiracy theories that were cooked up by military intelligence. And the way in which Donald Trump continues to push these ridiculous theories, and the way that they are now echoed by many of the Republicans, is deeply disturbing, not just because they're false, but because they really represent a tremendous victory for Vladimir Putin and a betrayal, frankly, of their fundamental obligations to protect the country. I mean, when Vladimir Putin sets out to think, hey, how can I get away with attacking American democracy and blame Ukraine? And then the Republican Party raises its hand. And so it's bad enough when it's Devin Nunes. But here you saw Senator Kennedy. John Kennedy, not that John Kennedy, Kennedy from Louisiana, and he is this amazing appearance on Fox News yesterday with Chris Wallace, and probably people have heard this, but let's play this again.
This is a fictional narrative that has been perpetrated and propagated by the Russian security services themselves.
They gave the server to CrowdStrike, or whatever it's called, which is a company owned by a very wealthy Ukrainian. And I still want to see that server. You know, the FBI has never gotten that server. That's a big part of this whole thing.
Senator Kennedy, who do you believe was responsible for hacking the DNC and Clinton campaign computers, their emails? Was it Russia or Ukraine?
I don't know. Nor do you, nor do any of us.
Okay, so David, look, Kennedy is not an idiot. I mean, he's a well-educated man. And we have been told that senators have been briefed by intelligence agencies over and over again that, yes, this was the Russians. This is not a close call. It was not the Ukrainians. It is the Russians. So what's going on here? Is this a massive troll of America?
Well, it's disturbing beyond what you've said, Charlie, because it's not just that some of these people are aware that this started as a Russian disinformation campaign and are choosing to repeat it anyway. But what we heard was using that in reverse as a weapon against those trying to call attention to the Ukraine matter, saying, well, if this is a Russian effort, you should stop investigating the president because you're just giving Russia what they want. It's like, no, that's not the point. The counterargument you're bringing up to distract is the problem. But they're using that very act as a weapon the other direction. To me, that shows that there is clearly a breakdown in logic here, but it fundamentally reflects the breakdown in ethics. Once you've decided that truth doesn't matter, once you've decided that defeating the other side matters more than any principles you once had, that's not merely somebody who isn't thinking straight. That's somebody whose moral compass has gone off center.
Okay, I want to talk about the impeachment in a moment, but let's talk about the latest story here. The defense secretary, the Trump administration has fired Navy Secretary Richard Spencer over this over the ongoing controversy about how to handle a Navy SEAL who had been accused of war crimes. Now, the Navy SEAL, this is Chief Petty Officer Edward Gallagher, was acquitted of murder but convicted this summer of posing with a corpse of an Islamic State prisoner. Under normal circumstances, he would go before a panel. And you, by the way, you correct me if I'm wrong factually on this, because I know you know this better than I do. Go before a panel of his fellow Navy SEALs to determine whether or not he would be able to retain his the coveted Navy SEAL trident. And President Trump had weighed in basically saying no, he was going to circumvent that entire process. He was going to keep the trident. There was obviously a lot of concern and pushback over the weekend, a lot of, you know, counter spins. And in the end, they decided that they were going to fire the Navy Secretary. And the Secretary of Defense is now saying that he was directly ordered by the president, the commander-in-chief, to make sure that Gallagher retained his Navy trident. So let's just start with this, David Priest. Yeah. You know, the president is the commander-in-chief. He has the power to do anything he wants, right?
Yeah,
this is within his rights.
Let's break this down. There's a lot going on here, and it gets more disturbing the more you look at it, because nobody comes out of this looking good. Start with Gallagher. What Gallagher did and was convicted of doing in his trial is horrific. He doesn't look any better because light is being shown on this and because the president has tried to make it better. The president, of course, looks bad because he's essentially endorsing war crimes. Now, Spencer, the Navy secretary, it wasn't clear at first, but the reporting coming out suggests that he went to the White House and essentially tried to do what John Bolton would call a drug deal, where he said, look, you know, let this process go forward, but I'll make sure that he comes out of it keeping his trident. Okay, that clearly doesn't make him look good. Whatever his motives were to either avoid having to resign or to try to avoid things getting worse, that is wrong. And I can understand the Secretary of Defense firing him for that. But then what the Secretary of Defense said later is, well, the president has said this is going to happen, and I had to say Roger that. Okay, yes, in our system, the commander-in-chief has very wide powers, directly from the Constitution and interpreted therefrom. That is why in an election, we take great care to judge the character of the person who will hold the title of commander-in-chief so that they don't do things like this. Esper doesn't look good because he may have to say, yes, sir, if he interprets that as a chain of command issue. But a lot of other people in that position would have resigned. They would have said, Mr. President, I acknowledge you're the commander-in-chief. You have the right to give me that order. I have the right to resign rather than carry it out because it's the wrong thing to do. And he did not choose to do that.
So Spencer wrote a very strong letter in response. He acknowledged that he'd been dismissed, and he wrote, unfortunately, it has become apparent that in this respect, I no longer share the same understanding with the commander-in-chief who appointed me. In regards to the key principle of good order and discipline, I cannot in good conscience obey an order that I believe violates the sacred oath I took in the presence of my family, my flag, and my faith to support and defend the Constitution of the United States. Now, by the way, I'm just going to say that I'm at this point that we're talking about this, I'm really skeptical about all of the spin wars that are going on here, including the reasons why he was
and
fired.
And perhaps, Charlie, we have to be honest. Yeah. Maybe the reporting is wrong, and maybe there was not that issue with the White House where Spencer made that offer to essentially rig the process. If that's not true, then Spencer's letter looks a lot like what you would expect an honorary senior member of the military, civilian or in uniform, to do. Given that reporting, we don't know yet. It certainly doesn't make Spencer look good if he's simply trying to spin after that actually happened.
Yeah, I mean, it did seem that there was a very strong attempt to discredit him, you know, as this was being announced. So really, again, I'm kind of withholding judgment on this, but understanding that in Trump world, trying to destroy someone's reputation because they've stood up against you is part of, now, he may have in fact screwed up, but his point about the key principle of good order and discipline, and going back to the point that yes, the president as the commander-in-chief can use, you know, can make political judgments, can override many of the processes and procedures of the military. But there's a real price to be paid for that. And so here you have a power struggle between Fox and Friends and the Secretary of Defense and the politically well-connected media talking heads when this is not good in the short run or the long run for respect for the military, for good order and discipline.
It's far from it. In fact, it creates problems that we may be dealing with for some time. Two thoughts on this. One, it goes back to an issue that I think you and I discussed several months ago, which is the president's power over classification and declassification. And yes, the way we've interpreted his commander-in-chief powers are that the president can ultimately classify what he wants and therefore declassify what he wants. So if he decides that in an Oval Office meeting, he's going to tell, I don't know, the Russian ambassador some top secret intelligence, he can do that. That is within his right. In this case, perhaps the president does have the right to tell senior military officers and civilian leaders what they should do in very specific military process cases. Perhaps. But that speaks to what we as the electorate must care about. And I'm still hearing on the campaign trail in the primaries a lot of discussion over who favors paying off all student debt versus some of it. I'm hearing about, is it Medicare this? Is it paying for this? Is it all of these issues? But fundamentally, there's one core issue. And honestly, the Democrats would be smart to focus on it, to say, we put into the presidency such powers that you have somebody who can effectively pardon whomever they want. Yes, there can be corrupt use of that power, and that in itself could be trouble. But there's a whole lot of executive power theorists who point out it's a pretty wide pardon power, just as it's a pretty wide commander-in-chief power. Let's think hard about whether we want the person in that chair in the Oval Office, or in this case, laying down in his bed in the residence, whether we want that person to be a person who respects the norms, the traditions, the rule of law, or not. That is the fundamental choice. Everything else be damned, because let's be honest, if Elizabeth Warren is president, she's not going to get past 90% of what she's proposing out there, because the math simply doesn't add up. It's not going to happen. But is she someone who fundamentally respects the foundations of this country or not? That's what this incident should have people talking about, not over the details of the actual process that happens when somebody is trying to get their trident back. It reflects a much larger issue having to do with the character of the person we put in the Oval Office.
Yeah, and a couple of more details about this story that I think are highly relevant, including the fact that this whole case against Gallagher was brought by his fellow Navy SEALs. This was not brought by, you know, hand-wringers in the Pentagon or, you know, pencil-necked bureaucrats. These were his fellow Navy SEALs who were deeply troubled by his behavior. And the process that was short-circuited by the president by the Secretary of Defense was him being judged by his fellow Navy SEALs, who would be evaluating them, you know, based on their code of behavior rather than on the president's judgment. And also, I think it's worth reminding ourselves that the president has a different view of the military than I think many of the people in the military do. He campaigned very overtly endorsing what we regard as war crimes. Remember, he was on the campaign trail. He's talking about killing the family members of terrorists, endorsing torture. Here's somebody who's, you know, he likes to wrap himself in the cloak of support for the military, our fighting men. But he has a very, I think, distorted view, because our soldiers are not killing machines. The president seems to think that whatever they do is all right. And I think that what that does is it downplays the role of honor and order and justified discipline within the military. So in some ways, while he's trying to, you know, show himself as a strong supporter of the military, he's also revealing his lack of understanding and respect for that code of conduct.
That is what you would expect, perhaps, from somebody who has a distorted view of the military. Obviously, he never served, so that's a part of it. But honestly, I know many, many people who have not served who do not have that perspective. So that is not an explainer by itself. There is something fundamentally wrong with seeing the military as a tool, as seeing the military as something solely instrumental instead of as an organization of people who have ethics, people who have had to walk that line between doing something that on day one is unethical and perhaps even illegal, but then as soon as a war is declared on day two becomes necessary for them to do. That is tough for human beings to handle. And all through history, there have been interesting rituals and ways of dealing with the stress that comes with that to every individual involved in armed conflict. The president does not know history well enough or care enough to understand that. And what that leads to is a caricature of the military, seeing anything the military does or a member of the military does, if it seems to him as it was something active or something perhaps violent, that it's inherently good, even if other members of the military look down on that.
No, I think that's exactly right. And this is actually a good segue because it goes to, and I think we've been sort of circling around this, the issue of impeachment, that the president has the right and the power to do a lot of things. But that does not mean that even actions within his quote-unquote rights cannot be impeachable. And also, there seems to be a notion on the part of some members of Congress that unless you have proven an actual criminal act, that it can't be impeachable. And as you have written, that's not the case. So I want to dive into that in just a moment. But first, let's hear a word from our sponsor. Today's episode is brought to you by Quip, makers of the Quip electric toothbrush. This is something I actually have. I've been using it for months now, and they want you to know that the one single discovery that matters most for your dental care is simply this. If you have good habits, you're good. That means brushing for 2 minutes twice a day and flossing regularly, no matter what brand you use. But Quip makes that simple. Starting with an electric toothbrush, refillable floss, and anti-cavity toothpaste. Quip's electric brush has sensitive sonic vibrations with a built-in timer and 30-second pulses to guide a full and even clean. And the Quip floss dispenser comes with pre-marked string to help you use just enough. Plus, Quip delivers fresh brush heads, floss, and toothpaste refills to your door every 3 months with free shipping, so your routine is always right. You never run out. You don't have to run to the store. It comes right to you. Join more than 3 million healthy mouths and get Quip today, starting at $25. And if you go to getquip.com/sykes, that's S-Y-K-E-S, right now, you'll get your first refill free. That's your first refill free at getquip.com/sykes, S-Y-K-E-S. Let me spell that out. GETQUIP.com/sykes. Quip, the good habits company. Okay, so we are back with David Preece, who is the chief operating officer of Lawfare and the author of How to Get Rid of a President. When you wrote that, did you know that it was going to be this timely? That it was going to have this kind of shelf life?
I'll give you the annoying answer, yes and no, which is in 2016, when I was working on it, it was clear that whether Hillary Clinton was elected or Donald Trump was elected, you may not recall because it seems like an eon ago, but back in the fall of 2016, people were talking about impeaching whoever got elected. That language was already out there. And my thought was, you know what? Man, we do not like ourselves in this country when we make decisions either in out of quickness or out of fear. And it's much better to make decisions when you've actually understood your own history. So I wanted to do that quick deep dive to understand it. Did I know it would happen in this way? Of course not. I was in that vast majority of people who, regardless of what you thought about Donald Trump, you thought once he enters the office and the gravity of the office and those who have preceded him soaks in, he will improve. Will he ever become one of our better presidents? Many people thought not. But will he at least grow in the job due to the strength of advisors around him and due to a sense of the enormous importance of the office? And what we've seen is a learning curve near zero. That has surprised me.
Maybe even sub-zero, because as not only has he not learned the norms, I think he's discovering that the entire system is an honor system, and that he can dismantle them or simply ignore those norms. So this is the question that keeps coming up, is the definition of high crimes and misdemeanors. And I don't want to put words in his mouth or distort what he said, but I had the sense that what Will Hurd was saying last week was that he didn't see that any of the information that had been presented, the evidence that had been included in the testimony, had established the commission of a crime. But the fact is that the president can be impeached for things that are a violation of the criminal code, but that's not necessary, is it? It is not. There are things that the president can do that may on the surface be a lawful exercise of his power, but are still can be regarded as high crimes and misdemeanors, correct?
Sure, sure. 2 points come out of that line of thinking. The first is what you're pointing out, that it need not be a crime. And think about what the founders did. They, in the Constitution, put in that a president could be impeached and removed from office for treason, which is defined in the Constitution very narrowly, for bribery, or for high crimes and misdemeanors, which even then was an amorphous term. It didn't have a very specific list of things you could go to and say, all right, these seven things are included within that and nothing outside of those seven is included in that. But they used that deliberately to get away from the term maladministration or bad governance. They did not want a president to be held hostage to Congress, essentially. Whenever they disliked his policies, they could impeach and remove. So they made it more narrow than that and called it high crimes and misdemeanors. But we know by that very language that they held off on requiring that the potentially impeachable and removable act be a crime, because high crimes are crimes, but misdemeanors explicitly are not. Transgressions falling short of criminality can inherently result in impeachment. Usually, we would interpret that to mean gross misdeeds, but even then, we have had constitutional scholars going back to the 70s who have come up with hypotheticals, things like, if the president of the United States were to go to another country, refuse to come back, and just spend his days, this is not the example used, but it's how I'm picturing it, spend his days reclined like a Roman emperor, eating grapes, drinking wine, and being fanned by slaves. If that is what the president decided to do, well, to me, that would be impeachable and removable. The president is not fulfilling the oath of office. Is that a crime? No, it's not a crime to drink wine, eat grapes, and recline in a foreign country. And yet that is so incompatible with upholding the duties of the office that impeachment would seem the proper remedy. No one can make the claim that that's a crime. So that means that there is a fundamental problem with saying, well, this doesn't hit the level of a crime, therefore we can't impeach. It logically does not make sense. That's point one. Point two is, if you make that case as a representative in the U.S. House, it is not your job to determine whether the president is guilty of that accusation. It is your job to essentially indict the president or not. And the standard for a grand jury is pretty low on whether a crime, or in this case, a misdemeanor, was committed. And it seems to me that Representative Hurd is applying the standard that a senator might use in terms of determining not only whether a crime has occurred, which we've already mentioned is not the proper standard, but also whether the president is guilty of it based on the evidence presented. That is what the Senate does in the trial. That is not what the House of Representatives does when deciding whether or not to essentially indict the president, which is reasonable evidence that these things have happened. And we have more than reasonable evidence that these things have happened because the chief of staff came out and said publicly that this happened. That is easily impeachable.
Yeah, no, I made the point that there's no mystery. We all know what's been happening. How now it's a matter of whether or not we're going to take it seriously. And the you know, some of the chop logic of people saying, well, we haven't tied the evidence to the president himself, you know, stopping the military aid. Well, you know what? If you have exculpatory evidence, have Mick Mulvaney come out, release all the emails, release the data. They're not willing to do that.
Yeah, I tweeted recently that the president and John Bolton, Mike Pompeo, perhaps Rick Perry, other, you know what? Come forward, testify, have it out there if you're so convinced that there was nothing wrong here. But let's be honest. The president wanted to use military aid and a White House visit as leverage to get partisan political benefits from Ukraine. That is undeniable. The only thing left for representatives to decide for the impeachment and for senators to decide for the conviction is whether it's okay that a president does. And I say a president for a reason, not this president. Put in Obama if you want. Put in any president you like or don't like. Is it okay for the president of the United States, any president, to use military aid and a White House visit as leverage to get a personal political benefit from a foreign country interfering in our country's politics? If you say that's okay in every case, fine. I think that's hard to defend, but at least there's a little bit of integrity there. If you say that's not okay in every case, then that tells you what you need to do in this case. And I don't think that's being laid out that clearly for representatives and senators right now.
It also occurs to me, and I'm not sure this is ever going to be the center of the debate, but I think it ought to be this sort of cloud over it all, is you know, the president's number one obligation is to protect the national security. And when you have the president becoming the willing dupe of a foreign power that is invading us and denying their culpability and failing to take the steps to defend the country and going along with attempts to frame an innocent ally, that is itself a betrayal of his oath and a betrayal of the country. And again, let's go back to this question of whether or not he needs to commit a crime. I was reading this impeachment handbook by Charles Black and Philip Bobbitt, which you're familiar with, you know, and they provide a bunch of, you know, examples of things the president could do that would not be criminal, but which would be impeachable. You know, they write, what if the president required all cabinet members to affirm their belief in the divinity of Christ, or that he devolved to his personal financial advisor classified information about upcoming decisions of the Federal Reserve? Because the president can, of course, he has the power to declassify any material he wants. There's nothing per se illegal about that. Or here's another example they offered. What if the president announced that under no circumstances would he respond to the invocation of NATO's Article 5, which calls upon the signatories of NATO to defend each other if they're attacked? Or what if he received evidence that one of our allies, say France, was about to be attacked with a nuclear bomb by, say, Russia, and our president declined to tell leaders in Paris, decided that he was going to let them be bombed? What if he received evidence? What if we received evidence that we were about to be attacked by a nuclear bomb, and our president declined to take action? Wouldn't that be cause for impeachment?
You know, Charlie, I think, what's funny about I think that, all you of list those all those out, and they're all reasonable right now. That is, not reasonable, but they're imaginable right now, is I could imagine this president releasing classified information to his financial advisor. I could imagine the president of the United States stating, of course, we're not going to defend our allies. And the sad thing is, I could notice some people saying, well, that's just the president, that's just what he does, and we got to support him. These were used as hypotheticals to show how ridiculous it would be not to impeach a president for these things. And yet, you can imagine now what the reaction would be if he did some of those very things.
Well, you're right. And this goes to this question, the sense among that apparently is spreading on the right that the president has this unlimited power to do anything with the federal government that he wants, which is to say a horrifically dangerous rewriting of the Constitution, rewriting of the presidency into a kingship. Neil Katyal is out with a new book tomorrow, making the case for impeachment. And I guess I'm sort of obsessed on this whole question of the, you know, the president has the power to do things, but it's still impeachable. He has another interesting example. He said, what if the president's opponent was murdered by the president's brother, and the president pardoned his sibling the next day? According to the Constitution, the president's pardon power is unlimited except in cases of impeachment, which means he would have the right to declare, based on the text of the Constitution, that what his brother did was, to quote President Trump, very legal, very cool. And because the president controls the Justice Department, he could order prosecutors not to charge his brother in the first place before needing to use his pardon power. But obviously, nobody's going to seriously argue that that's an appropriate use of his power. He has that power, just like he had the power to fire the FBI director. He did have that power. But if it was designed to obstruct an investigation, if there was criminal intent, it is an impeachable offense.
Yeah, there are so many of these things that in abstract, because you're picturing the president, you don't like doing them, that they said, well, of course, that would be impeachable. Of course, we don't want a president doing that. But then it gets wrapped up in the current situation, especially tying back to our earlier discussion, especially if some part of you or someone you still respect is talking about this person as anointed of God or his opponents as demonic, then it becomes easier to get yourself away from that abstract, of course it's not right, to the specific, well, yeah, in this case, he's right. It also builds on a huge amount of history we've had of presidents from both parties who have expanded presidential power. I mean, Andrew Jackson was one of the first to do it dramatically, but it's happened over and over again. Lincoln during the Civil War, FDR, clearly, Obama with executive orders in some cases. You've had presidents of both parties who have expanded Article II power and Article I basically having a few voices saying, this isn't right. Institutionally, we need to stand up for ourselves, but politically or for other reasons, people going along with it. This is the result of that. If you don't like a president you disagree with having a certain power to do something, you shouldn't agree to it in general.
See, this is what really is sort of disorienting for me, because the conservative movement conservatives have always been deeply suspicious of the concentration of government power. You know, you ask many pre-Trump conservatives what was the essence of their ideology or of their principles, it would be their belief in limited government, right? It would be their belief in the Constitution and its limits of the concentration of power in Washington, D.C., or certainly within the presidency. And now that's all eroded. And the real danger, I think, for Republicans and conservatives is that having surrendered their belief in the limitations of what the president can do, they will be absolutely unarmed when, in fact, somebody of another party and another ideology wields that power. I don't think it's a trivial point to say, what is your critique going to be when President Elizabeth Warren or Bernie Sanders or anyone else wields this unilateral executive power, or basically says, you know, under Article 2, I can do whatever I like? Because having basically endorsed whatever it takes, that it's all about winning, then you can't really oppose them on the basis of principle, and the quote unquote support for the Constitution becomes what? Is it? Are you constitutionalists, or are you members of a cult of personality at this point?
And the person that right now I think represents the good side of that is Justin Amash, someone mm-hmm, who Democrats
gets it.
Were holding their nose at until recently, until they see, wait a minute, we may disagree with him on 99% of policies, but his articulation of the constitutional principle at stake, he actually phrases it better than most of them do. Now, they're also in opposition, so anything they do is seen as a partisan attack. An impeachment is seen as partisan if it's against a president of another party, when in fact it may be, but it could be an actual legitimate constitutional process. Having somebody like Justin Amash come out and say, here is exactly why it's warranted in this case, regardless of what letter the person has chosen to put after their name in the election, that says something. What's surprising to you and me is that we haven't had more principled Republicans come forward and do the same. I'm still holding out hope. I still think we have people whom I know are principled and do believe in those values. Maybe they're keeping their head low. Maybe they're trying to keep the pressure off until the vote comes, and then they'll see whether they can actually vote based on principle or whether they have overwhelming reasons not to. I still have faith that some of them see what's really at stake here.
Yeah, I think I'm getting to the point of that hope is the triumph. Well, that any expectation that Republicans will do the right thing is the triumph of hope over experience. I was just looking for the piece that your colleagues at Lawfare wrote about the importance of having this vote, that we're at least going to see that. Yeah, here's the piece in The Atlantic, what impeachment is revealing about the Republican Party. It will make Senate Republicans cast a vote for the proposition, you know, LOL, nothing matters, thereby enabling the 2020 electorate to evaluate nihilism as the governing philosophy of a political movement, that they will have to expose themselves. So where do you come down on this issue of the speed of all of this? I'm concerned that the Democrats are making a mistake by rushing this. I do think they have enough evidence. I do think it is compelling, but I think that there's a case to be made for continuing to dig, continuing to let the evidence that's out there marinate in public opinion, and that it would be a mistake for them to rush this through by the end of the year and then go into a two-week-long truncated trial that would result in the president's exoneration. So given the fact that this is one of the most serious constitutional obligations that Congress has to make, that they ought to take the time to get it right, to be very, very clear. And yes, there may be some frustrations there, but there's more documentation, there's more evidence, there are more witnesses out there, and I just think it would be a mistake for them to rush it.
There's a real dilemma here, Charlie, which is they have to go into an impeachment vote, and more importantly, a conviction vote in the Senate. They have to go in with a pretty strong case, because we've been talking about all the reasons why people won't take their constitutional duty seriously unless it is smacking them across the face, and even then they might not. So it has to be really tight. There have to be as few holes as possible. And frankly, I don't think it's enough now. I would hope it would be, but I don't think it's enough for them to go and say, look, the president said this in his call, the chief of staff did this, and we have all these people testifying to what happened, and Trump and Pompeo and Mulvaney and others refuse to testify and they refuse to give us documents. That in and of itself is contempt of Congress and blocking the investigation. I would like to think that all adds up to enough for most people, but I'm politically savvy enough to know that it doesn't, that they need something more to nail that down. So, yes, you investigate to get that something more. The problem is momentum. We saw it with the Mueller report. The Mueller report came out. There was a delay of weeks while Attorney General Barr played his games and they were trying to get Mueller to come in and testify, and maybe he'd push back like he did in that letter he wrote to Barr. And in that time, the momentum of the collusion and the obstruction of justice faded, and they did not take advantage of the moment. What have we seen Adam Schiff do in the last couple of weeks? Yeah. We have had momentum. We have had people actually doing what some of us said was unlikely, which is people looking at their TV screens to watch live testimony, and there were actual bits of news that came out of those. Even though the closed-door depositions had been released, there were still new bits of information that came out that moved the story forward, that we would have banner headlines each day from those. That's amazing. And that kind of momentum is the kind of thing that just didn't happen with the Mueller report. So they have this dilemma now, which is, do we investigate these things further? Do we try to push in court to get some of these people to testify, to force the White House to turn over documents and other records? Or do we go with the route that they used against Nixon, which is against Nixon? You'll remember one of the articles of impeachment was failure to produce materials and other things, and that was a contempt of Congress charge. If they move forward with that, is that enough? Well, if there's no conviction, people will say, well, they should have dug deeper, they should have had more information, they shouldn't have gone forward on this. On the other hand, if they go really quickly, then they're in trouble. I mean, they can't get it right unless there is some Goldilocks zone in the middle that we honestly can't tell what it is going in.
Yeah, I guess I agree with you. I've been surprised by how much they've been able to get so far, but still we haven't had any of these records of these emails. And over the weekend, we got the Washington Post report about the internal investigation by the White House counsel. I would like to see those.
I suspect that it is enough of a damning case now, and they do have the goods to back it up, largely due to Ambassador Sondland revising his testimony over and over again so he would not be thrown under the bus. The real hinge point here is Giuliani. And Giuliani actually provides a lot of that connective tissue because he was out there in the press talking about exactly the fact that Ukraine needed to go after the Bidens and what was going on. So Giuliani is the one who is really in the hot seat. If it comes down to it, I don't think there would be any hesitation by the president or those closest to him to take Giuliani and not only push him in front of the bus, but actually take the driver's seat and drive the bus over him. The real issue is whether Rudy was actually being smart the other day when he referred to the fact that he has insurance, or whether he was just spouting off as he normally does. If he has the willingness or the ability to deliver the goods on the president, because he feels the president is throwing him under the bus, then I think it could be game over, because that could push things to a level that we don't have yet, where the president and Giuliani probably had some very candid conversations. Maybe Giuliani was recording those. Maybe he was taking contemporaneous notes. But either way, it could be much more damning if it's stuff in the voice of the president rather than in somebody overhearing what Ambassador Sondland was saying on the phone, implying what the president was saying. If you get some really juicy quotes directly from the president, that could move some people forward.
Well, and also we don't know whether we'll ever hear from John Bolton or whether we'll hear from former White House counsel McGahn. All of those could be, you know, really, you know, quite dramatic. And so I certainly hope that those efforts continue. But you're right. It is the kind of catch-22. David Priest, thank you so much for coming back on the Bulwark Podcast. Appreciate it very much.
Thank you, and have a very happy Thanksgiving.
You as well. And thank you for listening to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. Our episode today was brought to you by Quip. We will be back tomorrow, and we'll do this all over again.